Whenever.
Sure.
Good afternoon, everyone.
I like the way you get.
And welcome back to an in-person Lou Jones event after some time. It's good to see everybody who is here in person. I understand we have many people appearing through the Zoom. So with us today is Tom Schreiner from the Foley and Lardner firm and Frank DeCastri from the Reinhardt firm to do this annual event, talking about what's going on in the higher courts. The original purpose.
So many higher courts for you.
The original purpose was to discuss bankruptcy in the Supreme Court. I'm not sure there's that much going on in the Supreme Court and bankruptcy this year, but Tom and Frank will tell us about what there is. But if not, they may touch upon some developments at the Court of Appeals level. So with that, gentlemen, take it away.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Mike has accurately pointed out that there isn't much going on in the Supreme Court this year. Of course, Frank and I were discussing this. That isn't the first in the years since his now retired partner, Pete Blaine, and I started doing this. There have been a number of years when the Supreme Court hasn't been very active in the bankruptcy field. And we've always had to therefore step back, think about something to talk about because we still like to get together in December and everybody wants those December CLE credits. So what we are going to do today is something similar to what we've sometimes done in the past. We'll start with there was a Supreme Court opinion on bankruptcy this year. and that is the Fulton case, you know, leave your car on the street, Chicago will impound it while you try to reorganize your life case, decided by the Supreme Court this year. We talked about it extensively last year. At that point, it had been briefed. It had gone through the bankruptcy courts in Chicago, several of them, all of which with some hard to understand uniformity had ruled against the city. The Seventh Circuit had affirmed in an opinion by Judge Flom that refused to reconsider a decision it had made about 10 years earlier in the Thompson case, despite several changes that had happened in the meantime. But, you know, I guess it's good when the Seventh Circuit follows its precedent until it gets reversed. But it did get reversed. And so we're going to, it is to say, Frank is going to talk about Fulton again. I talked about it last year. You don't want to hear me twice saying the same things, even though what we predicted last year did come true. And so we could get some bragging rights on that. But we weren't the only ones to sort of see which way that was going. We just had to know a little bit about the proclivities of these non-specialist bankruptcy judges, because they are bankruptcy judges when they're deciding bankruptcy cases, I guess. People on the Supreme Court who don't care about very much and don't know very much and don't care very much about the substance of these things, but are specialists in what? I guess they're specialists in interpreting statutes and the Constitution and thinking great thoughts. And so we have a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, which will be our only Supreme Court decision to talk about because there hadn't been anything else. Sometimes in the past, we have, when stuck in this situation, talked about cert petitions that the Supreme Court had granted in bankruptcy cases that we could look forward to, such as Fulton last year. There isn't one this year. They've not done anything in that area either. There is, however, and we'll talk briefly about it because it's frankly not the most interesting subject in the world. There is a really interesting, though, to me, but maybe not to everybody else, case from the Fourth Circuit that is still pending. The U.S. trustee's brief was just filed yesterday, his response brief defending what the Fourth Circuit had said on the issue of whether or not this strange system we have in this country, where 46 of the 48 states fall within U.S. trustee districts and the U.S. trustee program, and two, Alabama and North Carolina don't. There's some history in that. I remember learning about this back in 1978 when this was new. when everything was new, before Northern Pipeline and everything else, when we thought we were getting something different from what we ended up with as a bankruptcy court. And I was told at the time, and I don't remember how it all worked out, but the fact that Alabama and North Carolina weren't in the U.S. trustee program had something to do with the fact that Hal Heflin of Alabama and Senator Irvin of North Carolina were on the Judiciary Committee, and they didn't like it. So there's a rational reason. The fact that it has continued unabated for the last 43 years, despite all the changes in the law, and that we still have these two systems, is interesting. And it's interesting on a couple of different grounds. One of them being that the Constitution actually gives Congress the power in Section 8 of the Article 1 to provide for a uniform system of bankruptcy throughout the United States. Uniform, obviously, at that time, focused on something different from what the debtor protection modalities of the day were, which were go to state court and get your brains beat out, different from each state. Some states still put debtors in prison. Others, depending on who bribed the legislature lately, forgave debt if it was owed to somebody from a Yankee state or England. And so Congress didn't, as you perhaps know, didn't even get around to having a nationwide bankruptcy statute. I think the first one may have been in 1789 and lasted a year, but there were a couple of what they then called panics, not followed by great resignations apparently, but panics in 1837 and 1873, I want to say, that led Congress to do something about it by enacting bankruptcy laws, but then were allowed to expire once the panic was over. That didn't change till 1898. We've had a bankruptcy, nationwide bankruptcy system since 1898. Was in pretty much the form that it started in for the first 80 years after that. 1978, obviously, was a big change. We had already by that time begun to call the bankruptcy referees, which were a feature of the original act, judges, although they still were not real judges, as we would understand it, because they still had a lot to do with making the system run. They were basically judges sometimes and clerks sometimes and arm twisters at other times. Maybe that last is still part of their job, I don't know. But at any rate, we've only had a nationwide bankruptcy system for 120 years or so. But now we have this little odd system now where, as I say, 48 of the states are subject to the U.S. trustee system, and two others have bankruptcy administrators. What's the difference? Well, Frank will tell you a little bit about that, but we're just going to talk about it a bit. It's not very interesting, but it has some real substantial difference between those and the U.S. trustee. This is sort of the opposite of Caroline Product's footnote. You know, this isn't a discreet and insular minority who are getting stepped on. It's the majority, 48 out of the 50 states. If you're a creditor in a Chapter 11, Congress has effectively raised the fees for a Chapter 11 case to astounding levels, trying to keep the system solvent, and hasn't done it in the other two states because those don't run the same way. So that's been challenged as violating the uniformity clause, Frank will talk about that for just a bit. And then finally, we go to the third option when we don't have anything in the Supreme Court to talk about, including pending cert petitions, and that is we look to see whether there's something in the Seventh Circuit that might get to the Supreme Court. I'm not predicting that this one will. It's just that it's very interesting. And I've learned a lot about it because it's Frank's case. So I'll be the one talking about it. It is an interesting case, came out of this district, and has to do with such interesting issues as what happens if you buy property out of a 363 sale under a confirmed plan of reorganization, and it turns out that someone with a recorded interest in the real estate had no notice of the 363 sale, or for that matter, bankruptcy, and that the purchaser was aware of that interest before it closed the deal on buying the real estate, and yet still wants to argue that the confirmed plan leaves that particular buyer in good possession, free and clear of the intervening interest, on the ground that it was resolved by the confirmed plan. So a long way around of saying we're going to talk about what we have to talk about. If you don't like it, nothing else to talk about. We'll answer your questions as always, and just wave your hand or just start talking. It's always been very informal in that respect. So, Frank, what's going on in Chicago and elsewhere?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. And thanks, Judge Helfinger. As Tom said, this is a case we talked about at length last year. This time we have a decision. I believe it came down in April or so. If you remember some of this, apologies that you're hearing it twice.
Sometimes it takes more than twice to make lawyers really remember things.
Yes, I'm included in that group. So, this arises from Chicago's municipal laws that authorize the city to impound motor vehicles for determinations of municipal liability. That's parking tickets, speeding tickets, and the like. And once the vehicle is impounded, it becomes subject to the city's statutory lien in the amount of the unpaid fines. So there were four Chapter 13 debtors in this particular case. Cases were consolidated, and they all had their vehicles impounded shortly before they filed their Chapter 13 petitions. In each case, the bankruptcy court found that by not returning the vehicle to the debtor upon demand immediately after the bankruptcy filing, that the city violated Section 362A3 of the code. And I will borrow Tom's.
It's only the 2020 edition, but I don't think it's been changed.
It hasn't been changed. Okay. Yeah. So, which says that a filing operates as a stay of any act to obtain possession of property of the estate or of property from the estate, or to exercise control over property of the estate. What's important to remember about these cases. Certainly, it was the way that I think Tom and I and others looked at it before it even made its way to the Supreme Court, is that these were not Section 542 turnover cases, and they were not Section 363E cases, which is to say that in none of the four cases at issue did the debtors actually request turnover in a formal way pursuant to Section 542, which is the turnover provision of the code.
Which requires an adversary proceeding, right?
Which it does. It technically require an adversary proceeding. And in none of the cases did the city request adequate protection of its interest under Section 363E. So in theory, at least, although as you'll find out, this isn't the way the Seventh Circuit saw it, if the debtors were going to prevail, they were going to have to rely on Section 362A3 alone to get there, to get the relief that they wanted. So on appeal, as Tom mentioned, the city asked the Seventh Circuit to overrule its decision that was in 2009, Thompson versus General Motors Acceptance Corporation, where the court said that the act of passively holding on to an asset constitutes exercising control over it. And that's a violation of Section 362A3. And
an asset that it had obtained possession of before the filing, right?
Right. And so passively holding on to it is exercising control. The Seventh Circuit, of course, refused to overrule Thompson. And in doing so, it really focused on the meaning of the phrase exercise control. It did not really interpret the words exercise control together with the words stay and act. Because remember, 362 operates as a stay of an act to exercise control. The Seventh Circuit really focused more on exercise control and said, you're passively holding on to it, that's enough. So what they did then, recognizing, I think, that this wasn't, these were not Section 542 cases, is they said that 362A3 is effective immediately upon the filing of a case, and it doesn't require a debtor to bring a turnover action. The burden is on the creditor to request adequate protection under 363E, and because 542 makes turnover mandatory, 542 essentially works together with, in conjunction with Section 362A to sort of draw back into the estate a right of possession. So what they said was the status quo, unlike contrary to the city's argument, is returning the debtor's property to the estate. And here, this is an interesting phrase here that they came up with. They said the city was not passively abiding by the bankruptcy rules, but rather was actively resisting Section 542A to exercise control over the debtor's vehicles.
And I'm resisting. I look like I'm active.
Actively resisting. Yeah. So essentially what they did was, a critical read of the decision would suggest that they are recognizing that 362A3 by itself doesn't get the job done. It has to work together with Section 542. And those two working together are enough to say that the city violated 362A3 and should be sanctioned for it. So the Supreme Court goes up, and I think as of our discussion last year, the case had been argued, because I remember we talked about the oral argument a little bit. Interestingly, representing the debtors was former bankruptcy judge Eugene Weedoff from the Northern District of Illinois.
Never shy.
And my experience practicing down there, I always had an opinion about things. But as he did here. So what the Supreme Court said is that the most natural reading of the terms stay, act, and exercise control, and here they, I think, didn't make the same mistake the Seventh Circuit did by focusing exclusively on the phrase exercise control. They interpreted all those words together, is that 362A3 prohibits affirmative acts that would disturb the status quo of estate property as of the time when the bankruptcy petition was filed. Saying that a person engages in an act to exercise his or her power over a thing communicates more than merely having that power. So something more than just having the power or control over an asset is required to violate Section 362A3. And then they decided that to the extent there's any ambiguity, look at what Section 542 does. 542 requires automatic turnover. It's kind of hard to argue that 362A3 would also require automatic turnover when you have a specific provision in 542 that says exactly that.
Except 542 has an exception.
542 does have an exception. It accepts turnover property that's of inconsequential value to the estate. And so what the Supreme Court said is, we know we can't read 362A3 to be the same as 542A because they would be in conflict at that point. 362A3 would require turnover no matter what the value. 542 would only require it if it's of consequential value to the estate. And then they looked a little bit at the history of the code and determined that this exercise control language had been added in 1984 with an amendment.
Really seemed to be directed at intangibles, right?
Right. Dealing with intangibles. And ultimately, the court concluded, based on pure statutory interpretation, 362A3 is not enough on its own. And so the decision in the Seventh Circuit was reversed. Interestingly, the Supreme Court, as I think was expected, did not address any other sections of 362A. And as anyone who's familiar with the stay knows, there are multiple subsections, including sections dealing with acts to collect, continued continuation of legal proceedings, enforcement of liens, things like that are all stayed under separate subsections of 362A. And we'll come to that in a minute, because there have been some decisions since Fulton where courts have analyzed how, in other words, debtors continue to argue that a violation of one of the sections of 362A is sufficient to require essentially turnover, and that sanctions are appropriate. And so there have been some decisions since Fulton. Justice Sotomayor wrote the sole concurrence in the case. And
she agreed with the interpretation of 83.
She did.
She's taken act.
She did. She found that, you know, just looking at the plain language of the statute, exercise control does not cover a creditor's retention of property that had previously been seized.
So but why would she need to concur?
She had a lot to say about, which I think really echoes a lot of the sentiments of courts that had found 362A3 to be sufficient, in expressing concern about what this means for debtors in bankruptcy, in particular Chapter 13 debtors, which of course is the context in which this arose. A Chapter 13 debtor that's going to repay its debts, you know, over a period of years, typically needs income to do that, and a vehicle is often the debtor's only means of obtaining that income by driving to work. And so she had real concerns and wanted to lay it all out that this is a problem in the code. She says the city may have satisfied the letter of the bankruptcy code, but not its spirit. She talks about the fresh start for debtors. She mentions, you know, of course, bankruptcy courts have 542 power for turnover, but as we talked about before, technically that requires an adversary proceeding. And she mentioned specifically the average turnover proceeding from 2019 to 2020 was pending for more than 100 days. So you can see the obvious concern for a debtor who needs the car immediately to get to work, but now is compelled to file an adversary proceeding and go through the traditional process and potentially including discovery before you get to a result. She notes that some courts have, wink, wink, decided 542 issues by motion. But ultimately, she said it's up to the Advisory Committee on the Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure to consider amendments to the rules. And she notes that Congress, of course, could amend Section 542. So from our perspective, not an unexpected result, right. But an interesting one nonetheless. Now, what?
Wait for the other shoe to drop, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And what can be frustrating about some of these cases, I'm sure from the city's perspective in particular, is you get a decision on one subsection of 362A, and of course there are however many others, just a few others.
And the city, you know, was not without some, I mean, it wouldn't appeal to the heart of a debtor's lawyer, reason for wanting, obviously it wanted money, but there was no incentive for people in Chapter 13 to pay for parking, not run red lights, and do people who are headed that way. There was no penalty for it. There was nothing effectively that the city, at least it argued, is to do to prevent abuse of the city by poor people. So important that is in Chicago.
So a couple quick notes about a couple of cases that have been decided recently since Fulton. There was a case out of the Middle District of Pennsylvania decided this October. And this one involved, actually both of these cases involved pre-petition attachments.
Post-judgment. Post-judgment in the state court proceeding, but pre-bankruptcy petition.
Yeah, so. Correct. And although I think in this case, the garnishment case, I believe it was prior to obtaining an official garnishment lien. I'll talk about that in a second. What happened was a company called Southlake obtained a judgment against the debtor. prior to the bankruptcy and filed a writ of execution against the credit union as a garnishee. Shortly thereafter, the debtor filed a Chapter 13 case, and the creditor refused to withdraw the attachment. So the debtor seeks damages for willful violation of the stay and claimed violations of everything from 362A1 to 6. The debtor said that the creditor has to take affirmative action to avoid violating the stay, and argued that Fulton doesn't apply because the creditor didn't actually have possession of the property. But interestingly, the creditor took no post-petition affirmative action and therefore argued it had maintained the status quo, similar to Fulton, and argued that Fulton's rationale applies to the other subsections of 362A as well. So this court, again, I believe it's the bankruptcy court, in the Middle District of Pennsylvania, held that there was no violation of 362A3. The creditor maintained the status quo. Withdrawing the attachment would have put the creditor in a more disadvantageous position than it was on the petition date. And it didn't violate the other subsections either. The court expressly engaged with Fulton's reasoning and said that some of these other sections, A4, A6, for example, also start with the phrase any act to. And so this court said it follows that a post-petition act is necessary to violate the stay. And here the lien had sort of already arisen prior to the bankruptcy filing, and nothing was done to enforce it afterwards. Similarly, the Ninth Circuit bankruptcy appellate panel about a month ago held essentially the same thing. There was no violation of any provision of 362A by declining to vacate a pre-petition attachment. So effectively, I think these courts are saying you got to turn to 542A if you want relief.
So they're looking to the spirit of Fulton rather than its letter.
Perhaps, yeah, yeah. And the last one I want to talk about is not mentioned in our materials because it was brought to our attention by somebody who I think is participating by Zoom, and that is a decision.
It was only decided last week.
Yeah, only decided last week. And it's out of the Northern District of Illinois.
There you go.
Cordova versus City of Chicago. Once again, the city is in the crosshairs, and this is a putative class action. In this case, the city moved to dismiss the counts in the complaint that alleged violations of 362A. And the court declined to do that. And their argument, of course, was based on Fulton, that Fulton applies, as these other courts have held, to the other subsections of 362A. And you know, therefore, you should get rid of these at the motion to dismiss stage.
And Justice Sotomayor's view to the contrary, notwithstanding, there were 8 other justices who didn't concur on those grounds.
Yeah, that's right. So what was interesting about the Northern District of Illinois, this was Judge Barnes. He really refused to engage on the question of whether Fulton's rationale and its reasoning, including the words any act to, would apply in this case. Really what he said was, well, Fulton only addressed section A3, which includes the exercise control language, and these other sections don't include that language, and therefore it doesn't apply.
That reasoning sounds backwards, because the exercise control language was the distinction that the Seventh Circuit had made and that Fulton District bankruptcy judges had made between that and the other subsections of 363A. So, look, it may not be an act to, but it's exercising
control. It's exercising control.
And that language isn't in the other subsections.
Right. So what I found most interesting about it, first of all, one wonders, it's a legal issue, and the court didn't want to deal with it clearly at the motion to dismiss stage. Maybe there's a little more factual development that needs to happen in the case, but it's going to come right back, presumably, in a motion for summary judgment. So it'll be an interesting case to follow. The court did have this to say, though, and he liked Justice Sotomayor's concurrence a lot. So there's a lot of quotes from that. But he says, he admits that from the debtor's perspective, that the code as it's drafted presents a problem. And he admits that the ultimate fix to these issues is a legislative one. But he says, but this court is not so naive as to assume that any such fix will be implemented soon, if at all. There are clear errors in the bankruptcy code that Congress has yet to fix despite being known for decades. What this court can do is what it does here, refuse to adopt in the context of a motion to dismiss a reading of Fulton that is so expansive that it eliminates clear and obvious remedies against recalcitrant creditors.
It bears noting that one of the things many things that Justice Sotomayor said in her concurrence is Congress should amend the statute and that the judicial conference should change the rules so that you don't need to have an adversary proceeding for a turnover action. But that hadn't happened either. And maybe Judge Barnes is right, that never will happen. You know, it's always a good bet. Certainly that Congress won't do anything where there are interests out there who make campaign contributions, I might add, who feel the other way about it. But not thinking so much of the city of Chicago as I am the old General Motors Acceptance Corporation of the Thompson case, you know, secured lenders. It is interesting. I wonder what will happen in the rulemaking process, which is not political at all, with respect to her suggestion that 542A turnover position, which the rules now clearly require be done by adversary proceeding, be done by motion. We'll see.
Judge Helfinger, does section, do we need all the formality of an adversary proceeding for a simple request to turn over a car that has been repossessed?
My understanding is notwithstanding what 7001 says, not in every district.
Yeah,
I've been told that I've read that there are some local rules that authorize bankruptcy courts other than this one to do things differently. Anybody have a question about Fulton before? I have a question, but maybe somebody else has a more insightful question than I do. Appreciating that this question is large, goes beyond Fulton because Fulton didn't deal with 362A6, or for that matter, 524's, the discharge injunction's prohibition on acts to collect debts that are discharged. The Seventh Circuit has a decision from, I don't know, 15 or so years ago now, which I know you gentlemen are familiar with, having then arose when a debtor, well, I think it obtained a discharge of a debt owed, a dischargeable debt, a debt owed to Cardinal Stritch. And the debtor then asked Stritch for a transcript because the debtor needed the transcript in order to get a promotion or something to that effect. And Cardinal Stritch declined the request. And that was litigated in the Bankruptcy Court for the Western District of Wisconsin as, I think, a discharge violation. But my recollection is that ultimately this went to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit didn't draw a lot of distinction between 362A6 and 524.
Judge Martin decided that Judge Crabb affirmed, and so did the Seventh Circuit.
Right. So it went to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit, the argument largely there, as I understand it, was that look, you know, from Cardinal Stritch's perspective, we're not doing anything. We're not acting. We're doing nothing.
That was a brilliant argument.
We're not doing anything. We're just not acting. Let's, you know, make this request. And the Seventh Circuit decided on slightly different reasoning than the lower courts had decided it.
Which is to say, Judge Easterbrook made it up.
In a decision written by for the panel written by Judge Easterbrook, Judge Easterbrook read Wisconsin law to impose an obligation on universities to provide transcripts when the student had otherwise completed all of the requirements or something. And ultimately the case, I think, stands for the, you may disagree with this, but I think stands for the proposition that when there's a state law duty to act, then a creditor can't decline to perform that duty without violating the discharge injunction or 362A6, depending on which one applies, on the grounds that the debtor owes that debt and that's why it's not acting. So does anything about the reasoning of Fulton call that into question?
Yeah, as I recall, Judge, that there were some different things going on, and Tom will have comments on this too.
Or not.
There were some different things going on in the Stritch case that were questions that were not presented in Fulton. So as I recall, there certainly was a question about whether there was a property interest in the transcript at all. And so whether it was indeed property of the estate. And it as I recall, the Seventh Circuit there, once it essentially reached the conclusion that it was property of the estate, and I think it was Wisconsin law custom, if I'm not mistaken. That was what he called it, custom. Tom and I both had to look it up, I think. I know I did.
It wasn't mentioned during our argument, but that's getting here.
It was not. As I recall, once the Seventh Circuit said it's property, concluded that there was an estate right to it, that was enough. And I do think Fulton would impact what the Seventh Circuit would have to say on this again, even in a college transcript case.
So when you say property, we're calling a contractual right property, because we're not talking about the transcript. But all we're talking about is a issuing of something that's based on some records.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah,
it's a customary topic. I don't know what it means.
It's not like property like this book.
I agree. The case is, if you're interested in it, and I don't know why anybody would be, unless you've got a client who needs to get her transcript, in which case you can rely on it until it's overruled. The case is In Re Keene, and it's mentioned on page 4 of our outline, as Justice Sotomayor talked about.
Yeah, she talked about that case, cited to it in her concurrence. So I think dare say she liked the reasoning of that case.
She did.
So what do you want to talk about next?
Well, why don't we talk just a bit about Siegel?
Okay. You want me to walk through?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So this is an issue that is interesting. At the end of the day, it's only U.S. trustee fees, but it's still interesting. I like it mostly because it has some interesting history, as Tom kind of alluded to it in his opening remarks. The question that is presented, and this is a petition for writ of certiorari that arises out of the Fourth Circuit. Does the quarterly U.S. trustee fee increase that was imposed in an act of 2017, which I think took effect the first of the year 2018, does that violate the bankruptcy clause's uniformity requirement?
That's right. That's the issue.
And the bankruptcy clause here, Article 1, Section 8, Congress shall have the power to establish uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States. And essentially what the 2017 amendment did was, this arose because the system
was out of money. It was bankrupt.
It was underfunded. Yeah. It was bankrupt. That's right. Because of the declining number of bankruptcy cases over the years. And so they weren't generating enough U.S. trustee fees. And so essentially what it said is if the balance is in the U.S. trustee system fund is below $200 million, then the quarterly fees are going to increase, essentially.
Talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars in quarterly fees in some of these Chapter 11s where previously they had been, you know, relatively inconsequential.
That's right. And we may not see many of these huge cases here, but certainly they're present. This one was the Circuit City bankruptcy case. The bottom line is the maximum fee went from $30,000 a quarter to $250,000 a quarter. So pretty significant increases.
All of that's money that will not end up in the pockets of secured credit, of unsecured credit.
Yeah, I think that's right. To the extent the lawyers didn't, you know, eat it up first, I think that's right.
We do tend to get in first, don't we?
Yes.
Good law.
So real quickly, by way of background, we had a decision out of the Seventh Circuit in 2019, the Cranberry Growers Cooperative case. I think it was Justin Mertz, Michael Best, who had that case. And that was a decision arose out of the Western District, I believe it was Judge Fury, that addressed the meaning of the term disbursement. And specifically there, I mention this so that you understand how broad the term disbursements are and how much, how easy it is to generate U.S. trustee fees for these debtors. In that case, the question was whether customer payments, the debtor's customer, that were made directly to the debtor's secured creditor, qualified as disbursements from the debtor. And the Seventh Circuit said, yes, it does. That those were funds that were essentially paid out on behalf of the debtor to the secured creditor. Interestingly, we could have had a case go up to the Supreme Court in that regard, but the Seventh Circuit found that the bankruptcy clause uniformity requirement argument had not been raised in bankruptcy court. It was raised for the first time on appeal and therefore was waived. So we didn't get there now, but the Fourth Circuit is there today. Real quickly, as Tom mentioned, before 1978, bankruptcy judges had all sorts of responsibility other than judging. They had administrative, supervisory, and clerical duties as well. And that was perceived over time, I think, to be something of a problem. I think
the problem. The
judges were appointing the trustees.
Well, I mean, you know, there were, I don't want to shock you. I'm going to talk again about Chicago, but there were places in this country where the bankruptcy system was just corrupt, where people were getting appointed as trustees in return for kickbacks to the bank, to the referee who made the appointment. There were a number of referees and trustees who went to prison, and it wasn't just Chicago, obviously, it was also New York, St. Louis, San Francisco, where they had so-called bankruptcy rings. One of the reasons why a lot of people didn't want to practice in bankruptcy was that it had this aura about it of corruption. And so the that's just unavoidable. And one of the things that that contributed to that was that the referee's functions by statute went well beyond deciding legal issues properly raised by the parties in the way that we think of judges and bankruptcy judges now, even referees at the end of the time under the old act do. That is, tee it up, we'll decide it, but, you know, bankruptcy referees, and then some of you, I don't know, around here, maybe not. I see a lot of old people in here. Remember going to first meetings of creditors where the bankruptcy referee would sit there and now he's going to be the judge later on, or would sit there and cross-examine the debtor about all sorts of things that we're not on the schedules and all kinds of stuff that seemed inappropriate. And it led to the provision in the bankruptcy code now that the bankruptcy judges may not attend whatever we call first meeting of creditors section, something else.
341, yeah.
Yeah, and during the time in the adjustment period after Northern
Pipe, still call it that.
Yeah. After their other pipeline case was decided before the fix, if that's what it was, in 1984, where the question was, well, could you handle it? If it would be, would it be all right if the bank, if the district judge's portrait was hanging in the room where the meeting was taking place, so that we wouldn't have a problem with a non-Article III judge being involved? But anyway, neither here nor there.
So in 1978, in response to some of those concerns, Congress launches the U.S. Trustee Pilot Program. And that was apparently deemed sufficiently successful, at least in some places, that they made it permanent in 1986. But Alabama and North Carolina did not like the U.S. Trustee system. And I actually went back and looked a little bit at some of the history here and what was going on in Alabama and North Carolina. Certainly the Alabama and North Carolina judges didn't like the U.S. trustee system, perhaps for reasons that Tom mentioned. The lawyers also opposed it. The lawyers liked the system that they were under. The North Carolina bar actually issued a statement that opposed adoption of the U.S. trustee system. And there were concerns about cost of the system and the bureaucracy. And there were also concerns about U.S. trustee conflicts with it being part of the Department of Justice, and concerns that the Department of Justice was also representing United States government's interests in some of these cases. So a little tidbit of history here, a letter from 1986 from the Chief District Court Judge Earl Britt, a Carter appointee, wrote a letter to the senators in North Carolina.
With an E?
I'm sorry?
With an E?
B-R-I-T-T.
Britt.
And he says in this letter, statistics prove that the proposed trustee program would be exceedingly more expensive than the current method of operation. At a time of fiscal restraint, it would seem imprudent to adopt such a new untested program. I urgently seek your support in defeating any such proposed amendments. So it's fascinating that however many years later, the program is having to be shored up because it is essentially bankrupt. So watershed moment in 1994, the Ninth Circuit holds that the lack of uniformity in charging quarterly U.S. trustee fees violates the uniformity provision of the bankruptcy clause. So in response, Congress enacted a law which empowered but doesn't require the judicial conference, and that's they are the ones who run the bankruptcy administrator program in Alabama and North Carolina, to set fees in those districts, those two states, six districts total, I think, that are equal to those that are imposed in U.S. trustee districts.
That fixes it, right?
Sort of. The judicial conference, yeah, they eventually got around to doing that. Okay, fine, we'll make them equal. Then we have the problems that we talked about. They're not generating enough U.S. trustee fees. It's no longer self-sustaining. And so the amendment, 2017 amendment, takes effect in January of 2018. The changes apply to any disbursements made in any calendar quarter that begins on or after the date of enactment. So if you're running it from disbursements, it means it's going to apply to cases that not only that are filed after the date of enactment, but also cases that are pending.
Where there are disbursements.
Where there are disbursements, right. So, but that 2017 amendment applies only to U.S. trustee districts. 9 months later, judicial conference applies the increased fees to the bankruptcy administrator district, but only to cases filed after October 1, 2018. So what this does is it creates essentially a class of claimants. For 9 months, you have debtors in U.S. trustee districts that are paying substantially higher quarterly fees than those in the bankruptcy administrator districts. And as I mentioned, the higher fees apply to cases both filed before and after the date of enactment because they're triggered by disbursements. And even when the judicial conference makes the same rule apply to the two states, those fees are applying only to cases filed on or after that effective date. So along comes the Circuit City case, a case that was filed in 2008, but of course, 10 years later, it was still pending when the amendment took effect. The liquidating trustee in that case initially decided he would pay the increased fees, but then changed his mind when the Western District of Texas declared the 2017 amendment unconstitutional. That was in the case of In re Buffett's LLC, or is it Buffett's? Who knows?
Dobert.
So the Fourth Circuit, at the bankruptcy level, Bankruptcy Court for the Eastern District of Virginia ruled that the 2017 amendment violated both the bankruptcy clause and the uniformity clause, relying substantially on the Buffett's decision. The case was certified for a direct appeal to the Fourth Circuit, affirmed in part and reversed in part, most notably reversed on grounds that the 2017 amendment does not violate the bankruptcy clause, the uniformity clause. And so here we are at the Fourth Circuit's decision. The Fourth Circuit noted that the Fifth Circuit reversed the Texas court in the Buffett's case. So now there's a Fifth Circuit decision going the same way as the Fourth Circuit. And they concluded, first of all, the uniformity clause doesn't apply because that only applies to taxes and these aren't taxes. Bankruptcy clause does apply. And the court concludes that it was uniform. We spelled out in the papers here what it really means to be constitutionally uniform, but essentially the law has to apply uniformly to a defined class of debtors and be geographically uniform. But then you have some cases that suggest that it can have laws that are fashioned to resolve geographically isolated problems. It's only arbitrary geographic distinctions that make a law non-uniform. And so the Fourth Circuit held that the 2017 amendment does not draw an arbitrary distinction based on the residence of debtors or creditors. Instead, it was only a byproduct of Virginia's use of the trustee program. And Congress was authorized to solve a fiscal problem that existed only in the U.S. trustee districts. There's a pretty strong dissent, I think, here.
Quattlebaum.
Yes, Quattlebaum.
Quattlebaum from West Virginia.
And Quattlebaum says, look, you're looking at the wrong thing. You can't look at this and say, there's no problem with uniformity because, there's only a fiscal problem in the 48 U.S. trustee states. You have to look at the underlying non-uniformity, I guess, if you could say, of the entire U.S. trustee system. And Quattlebaum says these dual bankruptcy systems are candidly and unapologetically non-uniform. And so he says the fact that the U.S. trustee program districts were the only underfunded ones, that's a consequence of Congress having treated them differently in the very first instance, a decision that was based purely on geography and really politics. And so it's not an attempt to resolve some geographically isolated problem. I recognize that the constitutionality of the underlying system is not at issue in the case, but as it's applied to the liquidating trustee here, it is a non-uniform law. As Tom said earlier, all of these creditors in the 48 states are getting paid less, essentially, because of the way their U.S. trustee program works and the fees are generated.
Quattlebaum concludes, no matter how you slice it, uniform means not different. That was true when the Constitution was drafted, and it is still true today. We'll see. I suspect the Supreme Court is not going to grant certiorari, because what do they care, right?
Well,
sometimes that's the answer.
Maybe so, although both parties admitted that it warrants review. So,
yeah, well, they just wanted to get their argument. The lawyers. I want to just talk very briefly. And I don't know, is this supposed to go longer than an hour? Does anybody know? Somewhere.
This may be a purview of next year.
Well, perhaps.
A preview.
A preview, yeah. Well, this is Frank's Archer Daniels Midland case. which is in the outline, and I think the outline sets it out pretty well. Basically, a right of first refusal recorded in the public record burdens the debtor's ownership of some real estate in Fond du Lac County. The debtor, the creditors of the debtor's Chapter 11 case proposed to sell that real estate to Archer Daniels Midland as the stalking horse bidder, who ends up with it. The owner of the right of first refusal, which again is valid, recorded, and so on, do not include the owner, Country Visions, as it's called, on the creditor matrix. Never give any notice whatsoever to that entity of the Chapter 11 or of the plan to sell the real estate in which it owns a right of first refusal. So there's no notice. Time comes in the bankruptcy when they want to sell the property in a chapter in the as part of the confirmed plan. Judge Kelly importuned to approve the plan to confirm the plan. Never told that there's anybody in the world out there like this, which I think she might reasonably have expected. She would have known because it should have been disclosed. Never told that by the debtor. Never told that by Archer Daniels Midland, which is the, as I said, the stalking horse bidder and the one who ends up doing buying it. And she approves the sale, free and clear of liens, claims, and encumbrances under 363F. Before the sale closed, clearly before the sale closed, Archer Daniels Midland became aware because the debtor's lawyer sent them a title report showing the right of first refusal in the public record. And Archer Daniels Midland never said boo, sat on it. And then some years later, when Archer Daniels Midland went to sell the property, argued that it was a BFP, that it was a bona fide purchaser without notice, that's sort of the issue that comes up before Judge Kelly, because ADM goes into her court and says reopen that case, which is now closed for what, 6-8 years, something like that, and reopen the case, which she did. And then basically require Country Visions, the owner of the right of first refusal, not to pursue the state court case that it's brought against ADM for specific performance of its right of first refusal, which, by the way, it prevailed on. There's still an issue going on in state court about what the damages ought to be, but the Wisconsin Supreme Court has held that it was entitled to specific performance of that right of first refusal. And the issue comes before Judge Kelly. She reopens and then she sort of says, well, what do I do with this? And I think sort of sua sponte says, well, I have to decide whether or not the confirmation order was void under Rule 60B4, made applicable under Bankruptcy Rule 9024 in this case, void because there's no notice given to Country Visions. There's some question about whether Country Visions had heard about the sale, but they're not in the case. And that's basically not good enough under Mullane for due process. So she refuses to set aside, she decides that the sale does not foreclose the owner of the right of first refusal from exercising its rights. She also decides that the Archer Daniels Midland was not a purchaser in good faith because it was aware of the before we close the deal. The case goes to the district court and sits around for a while. Judge Ludwig eventually gets it and affirms. And he didn't have much good to say about Archer Daniels Midland. Criticized it for its, as he said, stunning lack of candor with Judge Kelly and not telling her about this. And he's now out of the Seventh Circuit, where it was argued a couple of weeks ago by Mr. Castry and ADM's counsel from Chicago. I happened to stumble on, I didn't know Frank was having the argument, happened to stumble on the oral argument on the court's website the day it was heard. The data hearing came down. It hasn't been decided yet.
Like one just does.
Well, I do. at any rate, the argument didn't get very far before Judge Easterbrook, as is his wont, said to the appellant's lawyer, the ADM's lawyer, well, answer my question here. Does ADM contend that the bankruptcy judge's determination that that ADM was not a bona fide purchaser is clearly erroneous? And the guy, I mean, you ought to listen to it. It would be amusing if it weren't so harmful, painful to listen to. Won't answer the question. Judge Easterbrook doesn't like that. At one point he says, you know, it's really a good idea when a judge asks you a question to answer the question. He never does. He eventually squeaks out at some point, well, we don't question that. And then he gets up on rebuttal and says, well, I've been thinking about it. We do think it's not clearly, that it was clearly erroneous. And Easterbrook says, you never said that in your brief. You've never argued that it's clearly erroneous. I've been reading your briefs while you were looking at this. And it's in the bankruptcy court's decision, clearly made a finding of fact. The district judge said you had to show that it's clearly erroneous to get out from under it, and you've never made that argument. The words clear error don't appear in your brief. So we'll see how it comes down. I don't know. There may be some there, like Frank has about 8 different issues in the case. I think that's the heart of it, and it's probably one worth watching when it comes down. And as the chief judge says, maybe we'll be talking about it next year.
All right, Tom, Frank, thank you. That was very helpful, as always. I hope we'll all be back next year. Maybe even more of us will be back next year. One last announcement before we disband. The judges are again considering revisiting the local rules sometime to once again take a look at those. And I think maybe I've commented on this previously. I commented today because given the state of the world, I mean, optimally, I would hope that lawyers who are interested in gathering and talking about how what the rules should provide, what changes would be helpful to them, would all be able to meet in person. I don't know that, I hope that can still be done to some extent, but it's probably my suspicion is that if we start to do this early in 2020, it's going to require at least some limitations, maybe limitations on the number of lawyers from, say, one firm that will attend in person. And then the ability or the undertaking to also figure out a way to broadcast it virtually so that other lawyers who are either at the firms that some only person is attending or more to the point, lawyers who aren't local will be able to participate and therefore hopefully capture the best of both worlds. My fear in just doing it all virtually is that I just don't think one gets the same sort of discussion, which I really think is the most valuable part of that undertaking. So that's forthcoming in the new year. But until then, everyone happy holidays. Good to see you all.